I'm Claire Parker.
And I'm Ashley Hamilton.
And this is Celebrity Memoir Book Club,
the podcast where we walk into a house and we say, is there a hidden meaning? I don't know. We'll set up camp and see. And if you say, no, I just want to admire architecture, then you can just read books yourselves. But if you want to go inside, explore, do a little Arc Digest review, then, you know, join us here in this house where we're looking for hidden meanings.
Great.
Claire?
Yes.
Where are we going?
Columbus, Ohio, Charlotte, North Carolina, Tampa, Fort Lauderdale.
And in 2 weeks, we will be in Austin, Texas.
Holy guacamole. Actually, holy queso moly.
Totally. I'm excited, though. I'm going to see my niece.
Me too. I'll see her too.
And do a comedy show. And what more could anyone want from 1 week in Texas?
I personally want queso.
Yeah, we'll have queso.
Do you think Shayla, your niece, will have queso?
Yeah, she has a really good recipe. Claire, if you were to write a memoir, how would you describe last week's chapter?
Attack of the Claire Parkers.
Uh-oh.
I am feeling overwhelmed by the amount of Claire Parkers I'm coming across.
It's more than just the one?
Yeah, so in the book we're about to read, there's a girl named Claire Parker in it, and he lasties her a lot.
Yeah.
There's no one else he really firsty lasts.
But she is a C-L-A-R-E.
Yeah, but you know who else is Claire Parker?
Who?
One of the writers of Madame Web.
Uh-oh.
So I have been tagged in quite a few reviews of that film. I've been reached out to. Apparently there's a giant billboard in L.A. with Claire Parker's name on it, which is so weird because when's the last time you ever saw a billboard that had the writer on it? Especially because it has four writers.
I also can't really believe that there is a movie writer, like a writer in Hollywood, and we're just finding out about it now.
Her debut movie was Madame Web.
I feel like I've got a lock on the Ashley Hamilton scampering around.
There's a Claire Parker who went to Harvard, who's a journalist. There's a Claire Parker in Atlanta who got arrested for dog fighting a few years ago. She was a dentist.
You know how I feel about dentists.
You know how I feel about dog fighting. Neutral. I say, I don't care who wins. I just want it to be a good game.
You always say you're pro dog fighting. That's why you're always starting those little tiffs with Bug.
I say, I think it should be one dog and one surprise animal.
You're always trying to teach Bug how to be a better dog fighter. You're always giving her tips on what to say to a dog with ugly bangs.
Anyway, as you said, I feel that I've kept my knee off the gas. I've put my eye upon the ball.
And now you've got a lot more work to do to beat out these other CPs.
Well, I think I have to come up with a new name should I ever get on IMDb.
I guess we both do. Should we start fresh tomorrow?
Should I be Claire Jessica Parker? And then just go out and be like, as a Nepo baby. And have people be like, huh?
What if I became Ashley Alexander Hamilton and I said, give me all your money.
That's mine. Oh, yeah. Then why is my dad's face on it?
Everyone will say that Nepo podcast. One girl's dad invented banks and the other girl's mom invented shoes.
And we are walking ourselves right into the pot of money, baby.
We don't even need it because we're so rich from our families.
Anyway, Ashley.
Yeah?
If you're a celebrity and you wrote a memoir.
Yeah?
What do you think last week's chapter would be called?
I think it would be called... Oh, we're manifesting something that's going to be something. I have gotten, as you guys know, I'm on my real spiritual journey. I've gotten really into manifesting and all that stuff. And I saw something that said that when you are achieving, when your manifestations are coming true, things in your life start to go wrong because it's you shedding the past that no longer serves you and moving into a new timeline. And I thought to myself, oh, this is a recipe for some toxic delusion to say, oh, every time things aren't working out, that's actually things just, they're about to go so well that I have to shed all this garbage from before. I tried so hard to manifest this week. There was a full moon and I saw this manifestation ritual that I tried to do and you had to burn a piece of paper, but it was so windy outside. The match kept blowing out. And I kept having to relight it. And I don't know if you're supposed to
burn
it.
Can I ask, why was it important to do it outside?
Well, I didn't want to start a fire inside my house. Fire safety, Claire.
Okay, I just feel like if you were really ready to reach your higher plane, you would let what doesn't serve you anymore burn to the ground. And if that's your house, that's your house. You have to listen to the universe and you have to stop forcing control.
You're so right. By surrendering to the elements, I was actually exerting too much control. Today, my hot water was out and I had to take a cold shower. And I thought to myself, oh, this is me stepping into a higher timeline. and I guess I'm wondering, is it true? So, You know, as we manifest, I'd like to say, keep your eyes here, stay tuned. Things could either be going really well for me in the near future, or things will go worse than ever, and I'll just keep saying, oh, this is that last thing that happens before things go great.
Did you wish for anything that would help me?
Well, I think my success is your success, is thinking ship sinks all ships.
Like, if you wished that Bug would finally get her crush to notice her, that doesn't help me in the slightest.
That is not what I wished for, but I didn't look at Bug's manifestation sheet. I don't know what she was writing down. Probably something about sticks.
Should we get into the book?
Yeah. This week, we are reading The House of Hidden Meanings, a memoir by RuPaul Charles. This is his second memoir. There was one that came out years and years ago, which makes it all the more interesting that this book wraps up around age 35.
It also acts as though this was the first time he's ever relived any of these memories. There's a real feeling in this book of, like, I had to plunge back down. I did all this research. I remembered things that I hadn't remembered for many years. I had never been ready to do the work before, but finally it's been time that I must look back and draw conclusions. And I wonder then what the first memoir was, if none of that was happening.
Yeah, and this book is interesting and I think well-written. It is a searching for self kind of book. There's not a lot of tea. There's not a lot of drama. It's a lot about personal goals and personal discovery. And I think it's a really interesting book about fame. But if you are interested in Drag Race, we don't get there.
I'm looking at the acknowledgements and the first person he thinks is Sam Lansky.
Who's that?
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that is the co-writer of Britney Spears' book. He wrote the Person of the Year Taylor Swift article.
Oh.
He's kind of the it celeb writer right now.
Good for you, Sam Lansky.
I always find it interesting when celebrities choose not to acknowledge their ghostwriters, and I always wonder why.
Me too.
It says this book would not be possible without the following people, and then it's a list. And I do have to wonder why not say, like, with. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting about the author. RuPaul Andre Charles is an actor, musician, television personality, and internationally beloved drag queen. He produces and hosts RuPaul's Drag Race, which has received 12 Primetime Emmy Awards, including 6 for Outstanding Host, and has been the inspiration for the international versions in 15 countries and several spinoffs, including Drag Race All-Stars, Secret Celebrity Drag Race. He also hosts the podcast RuPaul What's the Tea with Michelle Visage. I guess, like, the fact that in the about the author, this book doesn't even touch any of the things there, that is fascinating to me. To be like, oh, these are the things that you would kind of define yourself as in your one paragraph to define yourself. What about the 230 pages you have to write about yourself? We're not going to hit any of that. Interesting.
So we get into it, and RuPaul was born November 17th, 1960. He is currently 63 years old, and the book came out today, this morning. You are getting it fresh and first. March, there's no way for me to... March 5th?
5, yeah.
Oh my God, happy birthday to my brother.
Oh, happy birthday to your brother. Happy birthday to my mom in 3 days. Okay, so the prologue is not the stage setter I think it's meant to be. The prologue is about RuPaul revisiting Atlanta in a late September. I don't think we have a year marked on this.
This is the setting of the stage for writing this book.
Right.
He's returning to Atlanta, so we can guess within the last 2 years, to collect some old VHS tapes for the research he's about to do for this book.
I'm much older now, but I still remember the way it was to know the ache inside of me, even before I was wise enough to be able to name it. That child within was craving that comfort and to realize that I could give him precisely what he needed.
He says that life is, there are seasons, and then sometimes things are destroyed, but they must be destroyed to make way for new. I remember when it was built 40 years ago. Now it's being torn down. Soon something new will be constructed in its place. It makes sense. Atlanta taught me this, and life reminds me again and again. You have to dismantle the old to make space for something new. I guess in that sense, he's like dismantling what he feels is a closed chapter of birth to 35 so that he can continue 63 to 95 or something. You know what I mean? Like, if you look at his life in thirds,
yeah.
He finally is at the end of the second third, so he can look back at the first third, which I don't mind his perspective, because I do think 63 is an age where you can look back at a lot of things and draw conclusions, but it's dangerous, especially if you're somebody who seems like he's still on the up and up. He's still so visible. He's still moving and shaking.
It's hard to analyze the now when you're still inside of it. So even if the book were to have, like, encapsulated Drag Race, like, Drag Race is still
happening,
burning hotter than ever. So to analyze it today would, like, not really serve it. So maybe that's what that's about. But it is very interesting that, like, why now with this book?
His very first chapter, his first memory is when he's on a blanket with his older sister, Renetta. She puts out some cookies on the blanket and says, "This is a picnic."
By naming it, she was making the moment something more than it was. We weren't just eating cookies on a blanket. The ceremony, the theater of it, that's what anointed this as something extraordinary, the creation of a kind of magic. Magic, I saw for the first time, was a choice and it must be created.
I think about this moment often because it was an awakening of something in me, the discovery that you can create your own magic.
I feel like if you have a memory that significant, that's that insignificant to like apply something to it like this, like I guess that is his truth. It was easiest to find magic in the television set, which is the epicenter of possibility in our house. He was obsessed with TV.
I love television. Television to me represented the platonic ideal of reality. First of all, there was a moral code, the good guys vanquishing the bad guys, good triumphing over evil. But even more crucially, the fact that it was all a performance was acknowledged.
And this is a really interesting perspective, I think, of this time. There were more Black people on television than there ever had been before. My older sisters told me that the people in charge would make it so that one day everyone on the planet would have 13 pairs of shoes, unlike me who only had one pair, or my sisters who had three pairs at most. The world was getting better all the time. In the meantime, the programs we watched, there was a kind of moral clarity that the real world didn't have. There is like this optimism that shoots through most of his life until probably his mid-20s and then comes back. Like the flicker burns out a little bit and then comes back full force. But there is this like intensity and optimism. It's very American Dream vibes. Mm-hmm. Like things are going well for us and like things are meant to work out for us.
My mother was a stoic woman in the neighborhood. She was known as Mean Miss Charles. But she liked me because I was easy, yet her coldness meant that I never stopped trying to earn her affection. He grew up, so his mother was a very like cynical person who believed that the world was out to get you, so you got to get it first. She never let her guard down. She was always quick to yell, tell it like it is. She had no shame. She did not care what other people thought of her. Her big belief was, if they're not paying your bills, like don't pay them any mind. They were very close. She liked him. She accepted him for who he was. She knew from the time he was born that he was gay. It was quite evident, and she did not judge him for it. And he loved to perform for her. None of my sisters perform for my mother the way I did. Imitations, bits, sketches, little scraps of makeshift theater. I would sit in her bedroom gazing into her big Art Deco vanity mirror with rounded curves and little engraved flowers and do commercials for Coty Cosmetics. That was my single goal, to pierce the dark cloud of her unhappiness for just long enough to help her forget that anything was wrong.
One thing that I think is so funny is her mom's given name is Ernestine, which she was named after her mom. And then one time when she was a teenager, she had a big fight with her mom, and her mom, RuPaul's grandma, said, "I wish I hadn't given you my name." So she said, "Okay, I'll change my name." And she went by Tony for the rest of her life.
So he says, "I never knew what really happened to my mom growing up, but he knew that she thought the game was rigged against her, so she was tough, and then people were unkind to her because she was tough, which reinforced her belief that the game was rigged against her."
His parents got together when his dad was in the military. He was home. He thought the mom was pretty. They hooked up. He didn't believe they could get pregnant the first time they had sex. And then they did with twins. So his two older sisters are twins. And then he was deployed to Germany. So his mom was raising two babies on her own and like couldn't handle it. So she sent one of the twins away with the grandma. And that like kind of created a whole rift within the family because that sister felt very neglected. Their family had a lot of tension. Again, his parents hated each other. They like really met that one time, hooked up, and then were a family. And that's not what either of them wanted.
No, as charismatic as my father could be, he was ultimately shallow, afraid, unable to transcend the strictures of what he saw as his reality. He was too ruled by his fears of being truly himself to allow me to be truly myself. I always felt the distance with my father. Physically, I was a replica of him, a mirror he couldn't stand to look into for too long.
Even with her very hard shell, I understood that depression sometimes got the best of her. His mom had a hard time, and she would kind of lash out at him sometimes and say, "Rue, you're too goddamn sensitive and you reminisce too much." She told him when he was 5.
But he has this optimism in him that couldn't be beaten. He has this memory of being a young boy, like second grade, going home for lunch. And when he got there, the door was locked and nobody was home. So he wasn't able to eat. He was waited the entire time to see where his mom was because he was very worried. Where else could she be? And when he went back to school, he starts to cry. The teacher takes him aside, sends him to the lunchroom, and he sits next to the principal and they bring him a free lunch. Above all else, I remember it because it was the first time the world had reorganized itself to accommodate the way I felt, which was different, apart from the others. I was the only kid in the cafeteria eating lunch with the principal. In this, I was special, but I was also alone.
So he really feels that there is this kind of like guardian angel following him around. Like he has this shield and this protection, but it is isolating to be shielded and protected.
He just feels like he doesn't fit in anywhere, not with his family. He's from this small town in San Diego. They had moved there with hopes. I guess his dad wanted to join the military, maybe. I think it was like a military base, but it was a very segregated neighborhood. And he said he felt like it was just so small and stuffy and conservative. He would take the bus to the beach and the kids would like make fun of him for daring to leave their tiny little enclave. He's just like, this just isn't a place for me.
He also just didn't get along with his dad's family. He didn't feel that he had anything in common with them. He says that they led with fear, which he understands and analyzes to be, you know, because they were born from freed slaves and they had this fear pent up inside of them because of their history. But he was like, you can't live that way because if you are afraid, you're still not free, which I think is, you know, quite a lot to put on his dad's family and say that that's why he didn't get along with them. But that's how he wraps it up in this book.
When he was like 7, he remembers going out to the boardwalk with his family. And when they were in the car coming back, they all had this mutual feeling, everyone in the family, of we can't go on much longer like this. There was a dead silence in the car. And in that moment, I knew this wasn't good. I knew that these people did not like each other. In fact, they fucking hated each other.
One time he comes home to his mom pouring gasoline on his dad's car and threatening to light the car on fire. And it's the first time he fully dissociates. His dad had been cheating with this woman named Betty. He moved out not long after into a bungalow off Highway 94. I could feel in his demeanor that he was determined to not change the way he lived just because he had a wife and kids. So his dad moves to Cerritos, which is outside of Los Angeles. This part is not explained. The first time I flew on a plane was to visit my father, but he was living in San Diego and his dad was living in Cerritos.
I guess nobody wanted to do the drive for no reason.
Yeah, I think it's like a 1 hour, less than maybe 1 hour. I think his dad might have been somewhere else and this memory is mashed up. I don't even know if they do flights from LA to San Diego.
After my father left, my mother took to bed and stayed there for a long time, several years. When I was an adult, I would learn that she had been to see a doctor who had prescribed her both Valium and lithium, but all I knew then was that she had checked out in a different way from my dad.
She was so devastated by the end of the marriage, by the fact that she had allowed her Achilles heel to be exposed like that, to have let my father break her heart. For the rest of her life, she would see him as her nemesis, the architect of her harm.
So he has all of these memories growing up of the small times he caught glimpses of what he felt was his future, things that resonated, little things that would add up to RuPaul and who he would be, how he would become famous. One of the first time was the show, The Flip Wilson Show, which Flip's signature character was a woman named Geraldine, which was just Flip in false eyelashes, maybe some lipstick and a wig. I knew even then that this was a major cultural event. Certainly it was for Black people to see a Black comedian host a successful primetime variety show.
She wasn't gorgeous, but she made us believe that she was. That's not to say I grasped what drag was, but it was a crack in my understanding of the world.
To me, it was even more significant that this character was popular, even though it was transgressive, a man dressed as a woman. Flip was someone who was violating the pact and still winning, which meant that such a thing was possible. He also was really impacted by all the Blaxploitation films. He loved Cleopatra Jones, and it was the first time he saw himself on TV. When you understand your secret girl, she can be useful to you. You can know her, this little avatar that lives within you, see what she's made of, what her characteristics are, and understand when she needs to be revealed to the world and how. But as powerful as your secret girl can be, she's equally dangerous when you refuse to acknowledge her and what she needs.
He saw Valley of the Dolls and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls and really did not like the explicit sexuality of these movies and was starting to understand like exactly where humor and sensuality and characters all combined into like his exact sensibility. It seemed that there were so many different ways to be a girl, more ways perhaps than there were to be a boy.
So after the divorce, the family really got splintered. The mother was very hurt, and I feel like she had like kind of a quick temper, as evident
by the time that she stabbed RuPaul's aunt.
Yeah. I mean, and like there was just little things. So like at one point, the twins go out to a birthday dinner with their dad and the new girlfriend. And when the mom finds out, she's like, get the fuck out of here. And she kicks them out of the house. And then as soon as she kicks them out, she calls the police on them as runaways. They end up living as like foster kids, almost, with a teacher from their school. Eventually, they move up with their dad for a while. There's just a lot of chaos in the home. And from very early on, RuPaul talks about how self-sufficiency was the number one lesson in the family, that you could not expect anyone else to take care of you, that you needed to learn how to do it yourself. And he says his mom was that way. Like if the yard needed cleaning, she cleaned the yard. She did not ask for help. She did not need help. And neither should you.
One thing I notice a lot in this book is the significant deep dive analysis of the other people in his extended family. And I feel like there's a lot of this, I've figured myself out very well. And like, here's why you guys are messed up. His mom hated his dad's family. They were never welcoming to her. They had a lot of problems. But when RuPaul's analyzing why he never fit in with his dad's family, he's like, you guys have a lot of trauma from like racial history. Not like, oh, I was kind of just predisposed to think you guys kind of suck. And so I'm going to apply that. Do you know what I mean? I think the analysis of why he doesn't like them feels very like placed in their court.
There feels to me like there's been a lot of analysis done on a lot of things. Like, here's why this memory matters. Here's the significance of this. Here's the significance of that. And then when he has something that he can't explain through therapy speak and therapy analysis in a neat little bow, it's dismissed altogether. Another theme that I find that fits in that category is his feeling of not being sexualized, or of like how he was always seen as the eunuch, as how nobody ever perceived him as sexual. And I just have a really hard time believing that.
Yeah.
I know that, like, obviously I didn't come up as a gay man in the 70s and 80s.
He's so beautiful.
And like, he's in New York City and he's working with drag queens and he has a lot of like trans friends. Like, he's just in these queer communities constantly, and these punk rock and these new wave communities. And this idea that like he was the one person that nobody could see the beauty in, I don't know if he's fully recognizing maybe the energy he puts out.
Yeah, because the fact that he believes the core of his mom's anger towards the world came from exposing her Achilles heel, allowing herself to be taken by a man romantically. Like, the thing that ruined her life was like engaging in this relationship with his dad.
Yeah.
And so could it be that he had like a really significant fear of engaging in relationships that way? And so he put out an energy of like, do not perceive me.
Yeah, because he's always
as
like,
a romantic option.
He's always like, people just saw me as a eunuch. I was always like the third wheel that couldn't have had love. And I'm like, I wonder if that's how you felt about yourself, because it seems like you were constantly having partners and relationships. Maybe you weren't the romantic lead in somebody else's life story, but who would be?
Yeah. He also especially acknowledges that most of his romantic interest was like on people who were either straight or just not interested in him. And I feel like that is the type of thing that we all have constantly when you don't really examine it. I have that problem a lot where I'm like, why doesn't anyone, I don't mean to sound pathetic, but like sometimes I'll be like, why doesn't anyone want to date me? And I'm like, oh no, I do get asked out like pretty regularly, just never by people I like. Do you know, like, and so I'm like, oh my God, I haven't been asked out in like a year. And I'm like, except for last week and the week before, but like not by good ones.
Also, all the ones that you think are good ones, you're like, I looked at their LinkedIn and I changed my mind.
I mean, no, that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, exactly. Like when I say like, why do I have so much trouble romantically? Like, it is so easy for me when I think about it for 1 second to be like, the call is coming from inside your fucking noggin, you dumb bitch. But I felt like I saw that a lot in RuPaul.
Yeah.
Real recognizes real, you know?
Ru recognizes Ru. Paul recognizes Paul.
Totally. So RuPaul hates school. He never really goes. And then one day him and Gary, his friend, get high for the first time.
You guys know Gary, right? From San Diego in 1968. You guys remember him?
Okay, so him and Gary were hanging out.
You guys remember Gary?
Everyone knows fucking Gary. Claire, stop asking like that, acting like that's crazy. Everybody has a Gary's.
I'm a Philistine of Gary. I'm a Gillistine.
Garystein. Anyway, so him and Gary are hanging out and they get high for the first time. The illusion that I knew the world to be snapped into focus for the first time. It was confirmation of the things I'd always on some level known. Life was one big fucking joke. Gary and I began getting high together any chance we could.
It felt like a freedom I'd never experienced before.
Renetta, one of his older sisters, ends up dating this guy named Gerald. They end up getting married. And then when RuPaul is just not going to school at all and like things are just going bad, the mom sends RuPaul to go live with Gerald and Renetta. And they're going to like maybe help him snap into place
a little bit. Well, he had like failed out of his school, and then his public school was really bad, and they had moved to a district with a better public school. So they're like, well, come live with us. At least you'll have hope. And he thought that was like the meanest thing anyone had ever done to him. So he said, you don't understand. What I want to be doing is smoking weed with my friends.
Yeah.
How is this going to prepare me for the life I want when the life I want is smoking weed with my friends?
Totally.
The best way for me to practice would be to be smoking weed right now with my friends.
There's also a bit of exceptionalism here, which he kind of cops to later, like really understands that this is a thing that he deals with. Most queer people understand the experience of growing up feeling that you're at least a little bit different, but I was really different, enough so that everyone knew it. Early in his life, the other neighborhood neighbors had called him a sissy and he could never break through that mold. He's like, even if I tried to act like a guy, everyone knew I was a sissy.
So he mostly isn't bullied ever, which is wild, except for one kid is like, I'm going to beat you up. And he hits him one time and that's it. And then he like gets a friend out of it, where this like hot guy named Lamar just shows up at his house the next day and is like, hey, I'll walk you to school.
He also views the fact that that one fight that he got into, the fact that it didn't go any further than like one hit on you, one hit on me. I was protected as if by some unseen force. But in that protection, I was often lonely.
So he has this like kind of flirty, sexually tense relationship with Lamar. But I think Lamar is straight. But I don't know. I guess it's all a spectrum and there was something there. I guess why would a straight, fully straight guy befriend the one gay guy in school who got hit?
And walk him to school every day.
Yeah.
I think he liked the attention.
But then he starts dating RuPaul's older sister in a few years. And I'm just like, oof, gosh, talk about keeping it in the family.
There are a lot of guys that RuPaul had a flirtation with and end up going for his sisters.
I guess it's like if you like RuPaul but wish there was a girl version.
There's three. I still hadn't found my community. I could see them on television, but I hadn't found them in real life. Renetta is really trying to get him to do a better job at school. She was trying to push me into an environment that could set me up for something better, something different. But I was a teenager, and so I experienced the decision as a way to restrict me, to choke my freedom.
So living with them, he's like still not really going to school, but he finds a teacher in Gerald, the husband of his sister, Renetta, his brother-in-law, who is like a real hustler, an entrepreneur, a go-getter. He's the kind of guy who talks about making it big and any day now he's going to figure out how, but people really bought into him and they believed in him and he believed in himself.
There was like this energy, that there was a hunger for young black entrepreneurs to make it huge.
And it was just the first time RuPaul had seen up close that you were allowed to have ambition. He had felt like he had come from such a small world where people weren't even allowed to dream of more. And finally, here was this guy who said, you want the big house? Let's drive through the big fancy neighborhood. Let's dream about what it would be like when we get to live here. Like, we're going to make it happen. Let's allow ourselves to believe.
He wasn't just selling cars. He was selling himself. So he's big on flipping cars. He'll like look through every newspaper across the country and like pick up old sports cars and fix them up and flip them for a better price. She and Gerald also adopt a baby
named Scott because she was working at Planned Parenthood as a nurse.
And this baby had no family.
So they adopted this 2-month-old baby named Scott and then immediately decided to move to Atlanta and drop Scott off with the mother.
I guess this was like pretty big then because the mom did it with one of the older sisters. Like,
yeah.
I feel like they end up kind of just like shuffling kids around.
I think it's good to have family support. There is something crazy about like adopting a baby and then immediately being like, well, gotta go. That's like what you would do with a dog. Do you know what I mean? And people would say, oh, you weren't actually responsible enough to have that dog. Him and his father barely know each other. There's a fake sincerity. He says that like he's not at all interested in RuPaul's life. He gets along with the sisters, but he just never knew how to talk to RuPaul. He never paid child support. Seems like they'd see each other once in a while, but maybe once a year.
Yeah. They were almost in a car accident where they like slammed on their brakes. They were about to hit a deer when he was with his dad. It's the only thing that happened with his dad that felt real. What do I mean when I say real? I mean, there are moments that snap you out of the illusion, the waking daydream as we all move through in this, the world that we've created. Everybody is born awake, sharp, and conscious. And then as you get older, you go back to sleep. But those moments, those near misses, the feeling of dodging a bullet, of circumventing a fate that seems so obvious, there's nothing realer than this. The reason I think this part's important is because of the amount in this book that he accuses people of being unconscious. I think that's a tough thing to put on someone else when you don't know their reality. Like, maybe they weren't conscious to, like, your moment. When you, like, catch glimpses of other people's existence, you can't be like, oh, they're moving through life unconscious.
So they move to Atlanta. He goes with his sister and brother-in-law. He was excited because Atlanta, as I understood it, represented the black boom of the 70s.
So Gerald is still flipping cars, and RuPaul drops out of school pretty quickly and starts kind of working with Gerald, where he would go to pick up these cars in other cities, which is so interesting. He spent most of the next couple of years thrifting cars and just driving them back across the country. So he'd go back to San Diego all the time, pick up a car and drive it back, go to all these cities everywhere and just drive cars across the country.
Because Gerald knew that they would be sold in smaller markets for less than they were worth, and he could bring them to Atlanta and upcharge.
Yeah.
He also in Atlanta starts having all these like experiences of the super religious black people that I encountered in the South all led double lives, especially that particular group in Atlanta. As pious as they were perceived to be, there was a secret second self roiling under the surface. And the fiercer their devotion appeared externally, the wilder that repressed self really was. When they moved to Atlanta at first for a few months while they're getting their feet ready, not feet ready, what is it called?
Wet?
Wet. Yeah, well, they're figuring things out. They live with a reverend or a pastor who's currently in hot water with his church for using his church funds to open up a nightclub. And then they're hanging out with his son, and the son is like, I want to go get my dick sucked. So he just like drives his car full of boys to an apartment, and the apartment was full of trans women. That language didn't exist at the time, so they probably would have called themselves drag queens, but they weren't performing. Rather, they were living in drag. All these like boys get their dicks sucked, and he's just like, what the hell is going on?
He says, as much as people will claim a hard moral line, that line becomes very blurry depending on what their needs are at any given moment. So basically, like, when you need to get your dick sucked, what's morals? When you need to get your mistress an abortion, God's busy. He can't hear you.
So I feel like he's like in Atlanta, this world he had heard of in San Diego of like drag queens and trans people. He's like starting to cross over. He's seeing it in his everyday life. He immediately enrolls in this school called the Northside School of Performing Arts, which he decides that he's going to go to because he hears about it. And he goes, well, I'm going to be a performer. So he just decides to go. I think he's only there for a year, but he's in a Tennessee Williams play where he gets to actually play a drag queen called Queenie. And I think that's a real awakening for him. He doesn't explain why it was so important, but he gives a lot of credit to the teachers there.
And he has a teacher who says to him, don't take life too fucking seriously. Not long after, I stopped going to school, but I never forgot that lesson.
He has this real experience of the optimism in him, I guess. Every time he's hurt, he sees it as exceptionalism.
Oh my God, it's like me with my manifestation.
Yeah. So he has a crush on this boy, and he goes over to the car one day, and the boy is making out with some girl. And he goes, I knew that I was lucky. It was never going to be me in the backseat. Being in the backseat was too easy. I'd been chosen, anointed. The universe saying, you over there. I just had to be patient and wait for my bar mitzvah from the cosmos.
There's this place called the Underground, which is kind of this queer underground layer of sexuality. And he goes to visit to see. And as soon as the man approaches him, he's like, actually, never mind. I'm not ready for this. As much as it intrigued me, the place was also the epitome of everything I'd been taught to fear in the world.
I'd learned from my parents that intimacy was dangerous, that to give yourself over to a man was dangerous, that it could only lead to ruin. I would learn from my mother's mistakes. I would be smarter. I would not be undone by the stupid primal desire to be held by a boy in the backseat of a car.
See?
Yeah. I mean, he has this thing where he's like, it'll never be me. But then he gets, I mean, even at this club, people are coming up to him. A lot of people are always kind of coming on to him. And he's always like, I won't just have casual sex, which God bless, as is his right. But then he's like, nobody sees me as sexual. I'm like, well, what about all the people trying to have sex with you and the fact that you always have a boyfriend?
Yeah. So Gerald starts freebasing cocaine while Renata's having a baby in San Diego and picking up the other baby.
The problem is this. At this time of day, and by day I mean year, cocaine was kind of seen as like the go-getter's drug. It was kind of entrepreneurial and cool and progressive.
This was pre-crack.
It was very much what microdosing is to the tech world.
Probably.
I mean, I do think that there was this idea that like cocaine, it's like Adderall.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't want to succeed?
Why don't we do more cocaine?
Dr. Pepper. Dr. Pepper is all the cocaine I need.
So RuPaul tries it, but he understood quickly there was something evil in this. Smoking cocaine, I concluded, was not for me. Gerald seemed to like it, though. Oh, my God. One time he's with Gerald. They're going to this drug dealer, and the drug dealer has a semi-automatic gun. And I don't know why this story is included, honestly. They ask RuPaul if he wants to shoot the gun, and he does. And he's like, it's the best feeling I've ever had in my life.
But it's also frightening and dangerous. Why? You may ask. He'll tell you. Because the power was temporary and ultimately illusory.
You can only feel it when you're holding the gun in your hands. It's not enduring.
The big lie of our lives is that we are powerless, that we need something else, like a job or a partner or fame or the dopamine hijack of a hit of cocaine or the chilly metallic weight of a gun to grant us power. We mistake easy pleasure or a rush of adrenaline for power. But real power isn't a high, it's something else, grounded and secure.
So he's driving back and forth across the United States, shuttling cars.
He loves it. He loves driving.
He's like, the power structures of lanes, right, didn't feel oppressive. Instead, they were organizing principles. A culture of civility, unguarded. The experience of being on the road, letting someone pass you, sharing a friendly look of acknowledgement across the lanes as they did. It made you feel proud to be an American, to participate in a system that was ruled by mutual respect. God, bring back
lanes. I think we have them.
No, Claire, it's different now.
At this point, his mother's confidence had returned after the hibernation years that followed her divorce from my father. She had gotten a job, become more dependable, had even at the age of 52 finally learned how to drive. In a family where everyone is traumatized, there's a kind of uneasy solidarity in the trauma, the shared silent look of understanding between the passengers who survived the same plane crash.
And his mom gives little nods of believing in him. So at one point, he needs $7 for this music that he needs for a performance. She gave me the $7 I needed, and it was a sign that she believed in my destiny. Not long after that, she got him a gold chain. She just knew that he was going to be a pop star. She had also named him RuPaul because a psychic said, the baby you're carrying is going to be a pop star.
It's a boy and he will be famous. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's like, oh, he needs a famous name.
So he says he felt like he was trapped in a liminal space, craving intimacy, but terrified of it. But I also knew I needed someone to help me decode who and what I was, which wasn't something anyone in my social world was equipped to do. So he goes to this gay center in Golden Hill and meets this man named Andrew, who helps him understand his gayness. And God bless, like, obviously he is exceptional. He's RuPaul, and we're doing his book for a reason. This isn't nobody's memoir book club. This is celebrities. It's not unimportant people's memoirs.
It's Celebrity Memoir and Stephanie Madoff Mac Book Club.
Ain't that the goddamn truth? But he says, later I would find out that I didn't have as much in common with the other gay people as I would have assumed. The only thing I really had in common with them is that we preferred dick. My tribe was bohemian people, some of whom were gay and others of whom were not. So this guy, Andrew, was reassuring, even keeled. And then...
And then at the end of a session, we were saying goodbye and he asked if he could kiss me, a real kiss. The question caught me off guard, but I kept my poker face. Sure, I said. So they kiss and then they like start kind of seeing each other. But Andrew's like, we can't shtup until you're 18. God bless, Andrew. What a not groomer for you to count down the minutes until your fucking prey is of legal age.
So they have sex. I remember wondering, is this all there is? I wasn't connected enough to my body to experience anything beyond physical sensation. We hooked up a few more times.
That's because you didn't like him. You were being groomed.
You don't have to be mean to RuPaul. It's not his fault.
Andrew, if you're listening, I'm pretty mad at you.
You know what it's like. You're taking advantage. Anyway, it ends when Andrew's like, do you want to come hang out with my friends? And he goes, these white San Diego gay guys who replicated normative straight culture in their own little territory with their codes of masculine presentation, I would never belong with them. I understood, even in a nascent way, that there was a divide between who was acceptable to society and who was not. The men who could pass for straight if they wanted had a form of privilege that people like me, people who could never pass, never would.
I love this line. To them, I would always be a flamenco dancer, interrupting the well-rehearsed choreography of their line dance. Hell yeah, baby. And then he gets catcalled and he starts seeing that guy for a bit before that guy has like a health scare and decides to be straight. It wasn't like a health scare, like STD health scare. It was a health scare. Like he just went to the hospital.
So he decides he's got to move back to Atlanta once and for all after spending a bunch of time in San Diego. And Lamar is going to come with. And then the day of, Lamar shows up and goes, I can't do it, dude. I'm not ready. Like, I have to get my ducks in a row. And RuPaul sees this as absolute weakness and abandonment.
Yeah, he feels crushed that he and Lamar are not going to be taking a Greyhound bus for 2.5 days across the country together.
And he goes, this is just like when my father wouldn't come pick me up from the porch. I was used to being let down by them because I'd felt that from my father so many times. I genuinely believed that I would do something important in my life, and I knew this belief would bear fruit. I had moments of doubt, certainly, but I never lost my faith. So many of the people I knew, particularly the men, were bullshit artists. They overpromised and underdelivered. But being on that bus all alone when I thought I'd be with Lamar was like passing through a psychic birth canal.
I knew from that moment that my life would never be the same, that I was letting go of something important, much as it hurt. So then he's in Atlanta and he sees this woman named Crystal LaBeija perform. She emerged in a camisole, panties, and a garter. She looked so convincing at first, I asked myself, is that Donna Summer? But at the end of the number, I knew it wasn't because she was so much more dynamic on stage than Donna ever was. It was like a revelation to watch this drag performance.
And so he's awakened by that. And then in San Diego later that summer, he's just home visiting his family and he gets a call that his dad wants to talk to him because one of his dad's friends saw him in the park with some men they knew to be gay. And so his dad takes him on this drive, parks, and basically is like, is it true that you were seen with these gay guys? And RuPaul goes, how dare you have the nerve to ask me about my personal life when you have never had any interest in me? We haven't received a dime of child support from you. I haven't received an ounce of emotional support. So it is none of your business.
I just loved that. I loved that response. I was very proud of him. And he also was like, I don't even think that was true because I didn't really have any gay friends. So who could I have been spotted with? He must have just like heard a rumor that I was gay and like concocted this story to be able to ask me.
But what really broke me was to understand as clearly as I'd ever seen it, how just small and selfish my father's worldview truly was. It would never have occurred to him to wonder if I was happy, if my friends loved me for who I was, if I was loved at all. The only time I landed on his radar was when there was a chance I might reflect poorly on him, that there was a possibility he might be embarrassed by having a son who was gay.
So back in Atlanta, there is this public access show called The American Music Show. Public access was a fairly new creation. Television providers allocated systems on cable for like local broadcast programming. And you could just kind of apply and submit a show. So there was all these random shows.
And one was called The American Music Show. and it was based out of Atlanta. RuPaul found it and was obsessed with it and wrote them a letter being like, please, I love your show. Let me be on it. And they call him back and they go, we got your letter. We'd love for you to be on the show. He can't believe it. And then he finds out later that he's the only person who had ever written them. So
they recorded it just like in one of the guys' apartments.
It was real rinky dink. But he goes, that's what I thought. The magic of it all. It's just us dancing, some made up dance in some guy's basement and apartment, but you put on a camera and now it's magic.
And so he makes this band called RuPaul and the U-Hauls.
He's always meeting somebody. He's like, I met a waitress. The next day, she was my band. So it's like, I was on a plane the next week and I found this girl. She was my new band. If you passed RuPaul, if you were a toll worker and he put 35 cents into the toll, you could walk away being his band.
We've all fucked up for having not.
Anyway, he says that like, even though it was a bit DIY, like everyone else in my family, they understood that I had a destiny and it would be fulfilled.
So RuPaul and the U-Hauls performs on the American Music Show and they say, oh, that was awesome. Come back anytime. And he did often for the next 8 years. So these are the tapes that he was retrieving when he went to Atlanta in the prologue.
And he loved it. He loved the DIY-ness of it. He loved this feeling of community and everybody would just eat. They'd all do a potluck style dinner and then they would just like work on whatever they could. He finally found people who just wanted to play.
How do you put into words the way it feels to find your people, to belong, to be finally understood, to know the connective tissue that binds you invisibly to others?
I can't explain the magic that enlivens those performances other than a sense of play, a spirit of goofy, childlike fun, an unwillingness to step into the quicksand of life's self-seriousness. It's impossible to put into words, but I know exactly what it is when I see it. It was as if these people had pressed pause on the stage play we call life, or even more so, that they had wakened to the great idiotic theater of everything society held dear. I love that.
So he starts performing on the American Music Show more often. As he becomes more of a member of the scene, he performs at clubs and parties around town.
Basically, he's just smoking weed, doing his dances. He's like making $5 here, $5 there. And he's just like doing acid and making friends. He meets these people, Floyd, Anna, and Mark, on a park bench doing acid one day. And they're like, you're high? Come smoke weed with us.
Floyd becomes one of his best friends for a long time.
He ends up dating Mark for a while. They end up breaking up. And it's like a heartbreak that takes him years to get over.
Mark didn't have a strong force field of protection around him as I did me. Whatever guardian angel had kept me insulated from bullying, from violence, from the brutality of the world that had carried me to the cafeteria at Horton Elementary School all those years earlier, there was something impulsive and a little bit dangerous about Mark, even though he was very sweet. It is such an interesting projection to be like, why didn't we get along? Because I was protected and you weren't.
Something very important to him was looking at the way that his mom's depression and sadness fell out of her. He says later that it was very important to him, no matter what he was going through, to never let his sadness spill out and touch other people. And he like talks about looking down on the goth kids because they were so self-important and so sad sack and so fake that like, why not be silly? Why not bring laughter and joy and just like lean into the absurdities of it all? And I think what it really means is kind of he had this outlook of it's going to be okay for me. And he was very wary of people
who like expressed emotional need.
Yeah, or who just felt beaten down by the things they were up against, that he couldn't hear it. He couldn't like let your sorrows take him down, and he wouldn't.
Yeah.
And so I think he's like reframed it as, well, I was protected and you weren't. But what he meant was like, I wouldn't hear it. And he says later, like the few times that people use slurs against him, he just wrote it out of his brain. He's like, I barely remember those times. It was very few and far between. He names like 3 or 4 times in his life. And I'm like, how could that be true, RuPaul? As an obviously gay black man growing up, in the 5 times in your life, people were mean to you about being gay. How could that be true? But he's just like, I don't know. I find it so stupid to call me any name. So I just don't pick up on it and I move on. And that is how he's gotten through life.
Yeah.
He took that message at 5 seriously. He said, I won't be nostalgic. I won't be sensitive. I'll be Teflon and I'll be silly. And I will laugh and I'll be high.
Boy, was he.
So in the summer of 1976, what age would he be then? 26 years old. That sounds right, huh?
76?
He's 16 years old.
Yeah.
Thank you. And he's talking to Mark and he quotes this drag queen he had seen named Lakeisha Lucky. She was up there on stage and she said, you're born naked and the rest is drag. I looked at him as if he had just unlocked the secret of the universe. Maybe he had.
I felt more masculine in drag than I did out of drag because I knew that I could command more power that way. Power being a currency that typically conferred to men. As a feminine black man in violation of society's norms by virtue of just existing, drag was a way to reclaim the power I'd always been denied.
So then he starts moving to New York City. This is when he becomes friends with this band called The Now Explosion, which has
Claire Parker.
They were in the tradition of the B-52s. There's a band I would have liked to see back in the day.
I think you can still see them now.
I'd like to see them back in the day.
Okay.
And they decide to go up to New York City, and this is like huge for him. They go up in a van, they crash on somebody's, ground? They crash on the floor, and they come back. But he says, New York City is in this incredible point where out of the darkness came roaring to life one of the most vibrant and exciting creative periods in the history of New York City. As disco waned and the new wave took hold, the Warhol experience was still felt in the bars and the clubs that crowded downtown Manhattan. Even from the vantage point of Atlanta, we all knew that New York represented a dangerous bacchanal of cultural convergence. So many ideas and influences intersecting on this one tiny island where anything and everything was possible.
So they perform at the Pyramid Club in New York City, and it is incredible. It's electric. To be on stage in a grungy New York City nightclub didn't feel exhilarating exactly. It felt more preordained. It was an incredible performance. They were scared about New York audiences because they're notoriously tough, but they did great. And the booker was like, you guys can come back whenever.
He's struggling at this point about not turning hard because he's getting his heart broken and he doesn't know what to do. And he decides, instead of saying that my love will be my weakness, he says, what if it wasn't my worst instinct, but my highest one? What if that need to be love was the best thing about me? He sees love as the opposite of fear. It's not one or the other, it's both.
Beautiful.
He also, from that trip to New York, discovers something important, which is Snipes, which are those giant posters that you see around New York City. And he's like, this is what I got to do. He understood from an early age that you have to brand yourself.
It's marketing, baby.
He was like, I got at 18 that what you have to be a star is not just talented, not just hardworking. You have to have an it factor. You have to have a lifestyle that people want to be a part of. You have to be able to build a world that somebody wants to live in. You have to have catchphrases. You have to have like a feeling. You have to have an oomph. And so he comes up with his own phrase and he Xeroxes hundreds of posters with his own photo on them. And the sign says, RuPaul is everything.
And he hangs them up all over Atlanta. The Atlanta music scene is blowing up. The B-52s are making it huge. REM is making it huge. Mark had broken his heart, but had I been enough for Mark, the full object of his desire, I could have gotten distracted and that would have upended my ambition. I could have languished or self-destructed in a relationship. So he's like, actually, it's a good thing that I'm heartbroken right now because I can dedicate all my energy to my career.
Which is great. I mean, it's true. If you're 24 and you're feeling heartbroken, let it fuel you for who you want to be.
Totally.
Then he also has this where he's talking about being in a car with Claire Parker.
You.
And she's heartbroken because she just got dumped by Michael Stipe, the frontman of REM. Even to Claire, who was in a similar position, I couldn't reveal the depth of my heartache. If the world was a casting director, I was just seen as an alien, a jester, an asexual oddball, not a romantic lead capable of being wounded as deeply as I had been. See, that to me is projection.
Yeah, I think you and Claire could have bonded over your heartbreak. I just don't think
anybody would have turned to him and said, you're not sad, I'm sad. Or I'm sorry, but if Claire was like more self-involved, why would you have been the romantic lead in her movie?
I was just too different to figure into the conventional romantic dynamics. Not because nobody desired me, but because there seemed to be that force field around me. I don't know.
I was perceived as other, standing outside the sexual hierarchy in which everyone else seemed to be able to situate themselves. This to me is like that preposterous idea of you're not the craziest person in the world. It's so crazy how everyone in the world is a sexual being except for me.
Totally. After all, it was self-evident that I was a star. The psychic had predicted it. And what did stars do? They created projects for themselves. Hollywood isn't calling. Do it yourself. Start a band. Produce films you can star in. Design your own clothes. Write your own books. I mean, this is great. That's true. Listen, I don't agree with the thing of like, I'm the only unlovable person in Atlanta, but I do agree with if you want to be a star, make stuff.
Create your own merchandise, build your own empire, become your own icon.
We're trying, Rue.
So then he creates another band called Wee Wee Pole.
That's not a name that I love.
Me neither. I liked RuPaul and the U-Hauls.
Me too.
This music, a lot of it is lip syncing. And then this is like an actual band where they were a bassist and a guitarist. But I don't even really understand what was going on. He reminds me of Sheena Shea.
Yeah.
I always think of Sheena Shea saying to be a pop star, you don't have to be able to sing. You just have to be able to perform. And I agree with her.
Me too.
But it's so funny the way he's like, oh, I'll be a musician. And I'm like, in what way?
Yeah. It's also so funny to be like coming from the scene with like REM and the B-52s. We're all doing music. Well, I don't know.
He also meets his lifelong best friend named John, who you may know as Lady Bunny. Do you know her?
Yeah.
I was waiting for a comment, but you were so silent.
I was looking. I was giving eyes.
To our podcast listeners?
Yeah.
Great. They felt it. And they just walk up and down Peach Street, always in search of some kind of good time.
literally just like hanging out with the working gals, doing drugs, go-go dancing, waking up, seeing where the night takes them. They were like, if we heard there was free t-shirts, we'd go get free t-shirts. If we heard there was dollar happy hour, we'd go get a hat. Like, all they did was menace to society as teens. They were just loco moco teens.
So Wee Poll's doing well. They opened for Now Explosion. They added a percussionist to the mix. I had my sights set on bigger prizes, not just becoming a rock star. I wanted to follow in the tradition of Warhol, who had created an entire world. That was my goal. So the goal really is just like global domination, which is
through persona.
Yeah, through vibes, which like I guess has been absolutely achieved
by him and others
thrice over.
I mean, it was really ahead of it. I guess it was coming out of that Warhol
era.
Yeah. So he does a lot of like drag lessons of the kind of the context into which he came. So he talks about at this point, there were drag queens in Florida and as far west as Houston, but all the traditional drag queens played Atlanta. Many, though not all of them, are trans women, and the objective was to give you the look and feel of real, to perform womanhood with full-throated sincerity. Most of them were pageant girls with beaded gowns and prom queen updos. We punk kids, who now belong to the new wave, were of another sensibility. Our goal was to poke fun at all that. Now, they may call what we were doing gender fuck, since it was born from a desire to deliberately explode expectations of gendered style. The drag establishment, a generation above us, would have looked at us and thought, those kids are cute, but we were never taken seriously, nor would we have wanted to be. He does ultimately find his true calling or his true success in kind of following the tradition of the older drag queens and like leaning heavily into the high femme drag queen idea. Whereas at this point, like he describes what they were doing on stage and he was like, it was a lot of drawing on a mustache, putting on a wig, using $1 to throw on whatever you found at the thrift store, like combat boots and a bra. Like it was all facets of performed gender at once.
Yeah. So one of his signature things was these like low cut dresses with chest hair poking through and like hairy legs, and it was to subvert gender ideals. So he's also making these films with a bunch of his friends. They're recording these videos and putting them on VCRs. What are they called again?
Yeah, VCR tapes.
I don't know. We had those in my childhood, okay? I'm old.
He was also making zines. He had one called If You Love Me, Give It To Me, and then he did an appendix and did a second print called If You Love Me, Give It To Me One More Time. But he wants to break out of Atlanta. He wants to be able to do New York like everyone else.
They get invited up to New York and they have this great show up there. At the same time, he had been evicted from his apartment in Atlanta because he stopped paying the rent after his ex Mark moved out. He moved back in with Renata and Gerald,
whose marriage had kind of deteriorated. Gerald's promise of success never seemed to manifest. He had a hard time with follow through and he'd been doing a lot of cocaine and then some. It seemed like their money struggles were catching up to them. And within a year, they had decided to separate. So it was a stressful time. I mean, he was making like no money at this point. He spends the next 3 or 4 years essentially homeless. Every once in a while, he'd get an apartment in Atlanta. But he spends most of the next couple years just like bouncing from couch to couch, sometimes just sleeping on park benches during the day.
By November, Wee Poll had broken up just because they hadn't gotten a record deal already.
And they had this idea that if a band doesn't make it in a year, the band has to break up.
Yikes.
Something that I noticed about this book that I found interesting was, as a gay man in a queer community, his only sentence about the AIDS epidemic was, for reasons I can't entirely explain, I was afraid. It wasn't just the threat of AIDS, which had appeared on the news beginning in 1981 and created a culture of anxiety. He goes on to be like, it was also just like my fear of what would happen if I really let myself go. And that's kind of the last time he talks about AIDS in this whole book.
At one point, he says that not very many people he knew died of AIDS and he was very lucky.
Yeah.
Which I found,
I mean, that is luck. Like, I don't wish worse upon him.
Of course.
And anyway, I found that surprising.
I wonder if it has to do with his compartmentalization situation where like many people that he has known and associated with, okay, I don't want to say probably did, but I just feel like from the amount of books we've read of performers who had any connection to the gay community, whenever they hit the AIDS epidemic, they like talk about what a tragic time it was and how many people they lost. And I feel like for Angelica Houston and like all of these other people who just kind of associated with gay people.
Or like Edward Enfield.
Yeah.
Elvira.
For RuPaul to be like, I really knew like one or two people.
Yeah, because I guess I even feel like if I knew one or two people who died,
I would still consider that a lot, I guess.
Yeah.
There is just like a very strong need to kind of be guarded, be protected against emotion. And even if he did not see the effects of it, surely people in his life did. And so it's an interesting way to have touched and then backed away from the topic.
So around this time, he starts leaning into this hyper-femme version of himself. My drag had always been Boy George-influenced mohawk and extensions, tribal apocalyptic Thunderdome look. But once I went out in high-femme drag, something changed. He, according to him, starts getting the sexual attention that he had never felt before. The way men were looking at me was feral aggressive. It was the first time I remember feeling that from a man.
When he was in high-femme drag.
Mm-hmm.
During this time, he's also getting high constantly. He moves in with Floyd and Bunny. In Atlanta, there is a sense of being a part of something that once felt so elusive and now felt vital. We all fancied ourselves entertainers. The other focus besides getting high was to plan some type of show. So they're just performing all around town, making movies, Super Booty, I think one of them is called Super Booty.
Star Booty.
Star Booty. Star Booty 2.
There's just this like mess of a few years. And it's funny, I think almost every memoir hits this murky part. We read it and we know what's going on, but then there's just this time of chaos where it's hard to get in the weeds of, and then we moved to New York for a month, but then we got evicted, so we moved back to Atlanta, so then I went back to San Diego. And I know that these times are so important and you don't want to leave anything out and every story feels so fresh, but when you're reading it, it feels like almost paper mache, like a stew of just like all these crazy experiences. So it's hard to tell where they are, but it's a lot of going back and forth and trying to make it work. Having a hard time in New York, coming back to Atlanta for a few weeks of respite.
But do you know why I think those parts of these books are so important? Is because I think it is necessary when you're reading this from the perspective of someone who is pursuing show business to understand that there's not always forward motion and like clear progress. Almost every career has this point in time where you are just kind of repeating and cycling and going to weird places and doing things. True. And it all kind of blends into nothingness. And that's the thing that you have to break past in order to potentially achieve any semblance of success. And I think that is actually one thing that this book painted so well is like the gritty part that people forget that you have to endure in order to be successful most of the time. Not everyone knocked on doors for 6 months and then was successful. A lot of times becoming successful means
a decade of not knowing.
A decade of waiting it out and like dealing with some murky, garbagey shit for a bit. Like, it's not always forward. It's not always clear. Even if you're RuPaul and you think that you're like preordained to have this great success, you still have years of bullshit.
Get high, have adventures, get ready for the weekend's gig. That was the life. I'd worn out my slogan, RuPaul is everything, so had moved on to a new one. RuPaul is red hot.
And then someone starts graffitiing, who is RuPaul? They say, who Paul? And then on the 688 Club, they write, in the blink of an eye, RuPaul will fade into obscurity. I took it as a compliment. You're nobody until everybody... Oh, you're nobody until somebody hates you. You're nobody until everybody hates you.
He starts doing this review on his own where he's bringing out his friends. He kind of ditches the idea of having a band and he starts bringing out his friends, Lady Bunny, Claire Parker. That's me.
And then they go to New York for a show and Bunny says, I'm staying. And they're like, wait, maybe we should stay too. So he and Floyd go back to Atlanta to pack up a couple of items. And then they go back to New York. And this is not a good time. They spend basically a summer there and mostly just crash at people's houses and sleep on park benches.
They had an inn with the Booker of Danceteria, which was like this 4-level club in Chelsea. And the woman, Ruth, was really nice to them. And that's also where Madonna got her start as
Check girl.
Can I say that is someone whose memoir I want to read?
Me too.
But it is brutal. They are crashing on people's couches, sometimes sleeping in the park. They have a closet at the Pyramid Club where they're allowed to leave their luggage. But other than that, they never know what's going to come. He's go-go dancing, everything. I have always believed that kindness is the highest form of intellect. From my earliest memories, I've been called names, but they never stuck to me. I could feel that these boring, mundane forms of cruelty were just the tics of those who had no imagination, like the kids in my neighborhood.
So the cruelty that he's experiencing in New York is really just not being let into the scene. There is this like kind of closed circle of who are the downtown darlings, and he cannot penetrate this circle.
So the Pyramid Club is on the Lower East Side, and he's like, the farther east you get, the more self-serious and punk and like cynical and campy impressed type of person there are. Among the cool kids of the downtown scene, I was treated with disdain. And while we found pockets of kindness here and there, there was something frostbitten about the East Village people.
And then he tells this story about seeing Madonna at an industry panel and then later going to the Green Room Danceteria. And Madonna was in there kind of holding court and like really stared RuPaul down like, why are you in here? And this whole story is basically to say that Madonna was really mean.
I felt intuitively that in an instant she had sized me up and seen that I was nothing of value to provide her. The world ran on a system where sex conferred power. She had become such a big star by seizing control of her sexuality. but that also meant that she sized up everybody she encountered, determining whether they'd add anything to the equation. And clocking me as a eunuch, I became worthless to her. It was a microcosm for the rest of the world, but I saw it most clearly in her.
I guess I do feel that throwing this wordless exchange about Madonna in here to paint Madonna as like a terrible and mean person is a little pointed.
I guess my question is the use of the word eunuch. I do fully believe, and I know because I've been in experiences with people in the industry where I've been determined not important, and then they just do not turn on the charm.
Yeah. We've both had people where like everyone says, oh, this person's so nice. And you're like, am I the only person that they don't feel the need to impress?
And the answer is often yes, but, and like rightfully so. But I don't know. The idea that like in clocking me as a eunuch, that's where the projection to me feels much in his head.
Yeah.
Anyway, it is a very vicious place, New York City.
And as winter starts to descend, Floyd and RuPaul say, we actually can't stay in New York for the winter because we are homeless. One question I have is, why did it never occur to them to rent an apartment?
I don't know.
Like, I know they didn't have a lot of money.
But he says he was like go-go dancing and sometimes he'd make as much as $50, $120 a night. There had to be a room that him and Floyd could have split.
For like $300 and like a 6-floor walk up in the East Village.
Yeah.
I also wonder why there was no consideration of like, what if we waited tables?
I felt that way too. I was like, surely there was something that could be done. I guess the thing is he was like a drug addict.
Yeah.
And that is kind of the big reveal at the end of this book that was there along.
Totally.
When he says we were waking up, getting high, going to go-go dances, going to parties and just doing drugs and drinking until we passed out and then woke up. Like,
spoiler alert.
I guess that's why he couldn't be a waiter.
Yeah.
So he goes back to Atlanta for the winter.
And then he's kind of bopping back and forth, like just kind of go-go dancing, making movies, doing performances.
This is when he does Star Booty. And that kind of takes off. It's a parody of blaxploitation films where he plays a drag queen character kind of based on Cleopatra Jones. And he helps save the kidnapped Reagan children. And it kind of blows up and it becomes very camp. And they play it in gay bars all around the world, or not world, but the country. Some people are offering to fly him out to host viewing parties. It becomes a little taste of the fame that he's been craving. He also meets these people, Randy and Fenton, who have a record deal and they are trying to help him. He's just like constantly making new friends and everybody's working at it. And he's kind of making deals with everyone.
Yeah. So he's still kind of couch surfing. He's staying with his sister, but then she decides to move back to San Diego. He considers going to London because one of his friends had bought a plane ticket to London and couldn't go. So they were like, well, I can't get a refund on this ticket. So do you want to go? And so he goes, but because he doesn't have a return flight, customs won't let him through and they just send him right back. Then he tries to fly home to San Diego and can't afford to get to San Diego. So he thinks that if he gets on a plane that's stopping in Dallas but ultimately going to San Diego, he thinks he can just stay on the plane. And so then he gets to Dallas. It turns out the plane is going to Atlanta. And so now he's just stranded in Dallas. He calls his mom and his mom's like, well, your sister's going to be going to Louisiana. She can probably pick you up in Dallas. And so then he's just waiting around Dallas for a couple of days for his sister to come get him. It is a dark situation.
Then he moves to LA for a little bit and crashes on his sister's couch. He says there's a lot of tension there, that all the siblings have this residual tension from their kind of fucked up upbringing.
And then finally, his friend Larry calls him and says, you have to come back to New York. Larry has some stuff churning and RuPaul would often back up Larry in his performances. So he's like, okay, he needed me for these things.
He also says, Larry also knew that I was something special and together we made magic. So if I had thrown in the towel and returned to my old life, that would have only distanced him further from his own aspirations.
But he realizes, he makes the decision, when I return to New York, I'm going to do it as a high femme glamazon. So previously, the performances and the drag had been this gender bending kind of punk version of drag. But he says, no, I'm going to go back and I'm going to do it big and I'm going to do it fancy.
A style I described at the time as somewhere between black hooker and soul train dancer. My body was built for drag. I knew that. The proportions were just right for it. Long, long legs with a tiny waist. And he goes and it does start working and he starts making these connections and he becomes like part of the scene. This is the heyday of clubs having specific promoters for weekday parties. So he gets like hooked up with all these people that are part of the scene. Suzanne Bartscht, all the cool people. And he's like, all right, this is my chance to become part of the IT nightlife scene.
Soon we started to feel unstoppable, the IT girls of the New York nightlife. A southern contingency had come to the north to transform this scene. So there's this pageant for like the king and queen of the downtown scene, and RuPaul was crowned queen. I'd charmed the toughest audience in the world. If I could do that, I could do anything.
But of course, that spring, I was in the kitchen one day when Renetta called. Mama has cancer, she told me quietly. She would get treatment and beat it back. She had to. That's my mother's personality.
Because RuPaul is now Queen of New York, there's much more opportunities that have been afforded. But RuPaul is just like doing drugs and partying. And then all of a sudden, there's this realization. I could feel that I was beginning to make the wrong moves. The currency I'd been afforded as Queen of Manhattan was something that I wasn't spending intelligently. I decided I would not go to a club unless I was being paid to be there. I was going to stop using chemicals and I was going to clean my act up.
Yeah, Lady Bunny has once said to me, you're up on that stage and you think you're funny, but you're not funny. You're just drunk.
Yikes.
So he starts going to the gym and taking aerobics, and you can feel that all of his old party friends are like, what's going on with Rue? And he's very resentful. He's like, once again, I'm alienated in the group. But I'm like, well, you are making like a different life choice. And I don't think it's the wrong life choice. I think it's very good for you. But you can't be shocked that the people that you used to party with every day, that's one day you just stop seeing them working out and completely change who you are. And they're like, what the fuck?
Yeah. They're doing these performances all over the world. Larry has a gig in Rome that he brings Rue to back him up at. It occurred to me that I'd surpassed my parents, that my world was already bigger than theirs had ever been.
So his friends Randy and Fenton cut a demo with him and send it to Tommy Boy Records. And they call back and they're like, we want to make a record with him. And he had this idea for a song they had actually got from Larry. And it was about encompassing the vibe of the supermodel. It was the supermodel heyday. It was the late 80s. And everybody wanted to be just this beautiful woman. And it was based on the Linda Evangelista famous quote about refusing to get out of bed for less than $10,000 a day. So they try to bottle that zeitgeist. And what they put out is the song Supermodel. Now I can see that everything was building towards this. Everything I experienced, the highs, the fears, the joys, the lows, the discoveries, had shaped me into the force I would become with that song and the change in my look.
I heard Supermodel playing on Z100. It wasn't a surprise. It was the most obvious thing in the world. Drag had been around forever. Why had I been able to crack the code after so many false starts and almost? I'd mastered the art of the naughty light. 2 spoonfuls of Diana Ross, a pinch of Cher, a shake of Dolly Parton.
All sealed with Walt Disney's family friendliness. Before I'd been blurry, confusing, a thing that only some people could understand. Finally, I had snapped into focus just in time for the whole world to see.
So RuPaul becomes essentially famous overnight. Within a year, he's being flown out to play the after party at a Versace fashion show in Milan.
And like the year before, he had been homeless.
Yeah.
Letting go is the most profound thing any of us will do in our lifetime. Death is inevitable, is a part of life, life's shadow. So not long after Supermodel came out, Randy and I went to California and he sees his mom and it's clear that she's going to die soon. But before she passes away, she gets to see RuPaul on TV living out the prophecy that he would become famous, that he would be celebrated all over the world. Each of us is responsible for ourselves. That is an uncomfortable truth that many of us do not want to accept. We grow up wanting to believe that a benevolent force, maybe our parents, will take care of us forever. But in actuality, we can only ever control ourselves.
She went downhill fast. Before she died, my niece Morgan had called to tell me Mama had lost her hearing, but it was about what she needed to say. Rue, she said, I just want to tell you that I know you and I love you so much and I'm proud of you. And then he's performing at this gay rights rally in Washington, D.C. And as he's getting ready to perform, he realizes, oh, my mother. And when he gets off stage and he goes home, one of his friends says, your sister called. And he knows that his mom is gone. My mother had said that she wanted to be cremated, or better yet, she said, leave my body on the curb and let the city bury me. I've paid enough fucking taxes. Yes, bitch.
So now the next chapter opens like ding, is him coming out of the elevator in his West Village apartment. He's like, I cannot believe that within a year of being homeless, I'm now in a West Village apartment with a fucking elevator, which is impressive stuff.
Fame was a runaway train. After courting it for so long, treating it as more of an inevitability than a dream, I found that I was part of the zeitgeist in a way that superseded me. He'll be like walking around town and hear people just discussing RuPaul as a concept and like not know that he's standing right behind them, because when they see him on TV and stuff, he's in full drag and they just don't know that the guy walking near them is like the guy.
So he goes through a breakup with his ex at the time. He goes out to dance one night and he sees the tallest guy in the room and he runs over and he goes, oh my God, can I like touch you? I've never seen a guy even taller than me.
Dude, I'm so similar to RuPaul in so many ways.
Yeah, there's never been a man taller than 5'8".
No, but just the fact that he's like, the thing that I do when I walk into a room is I scan the room for the tallest person.
So he meets this guy, George, with an S.
George's.
Gorgas.
Gorgas.
Like Melissa and Joe Gorgas.
Yeah.
And he's like, listen, I was supposed to take my boyfriend to the Brit Awards tomorrow. I'm hosting with Elton John. Do you want to come instead? And Gorgas is like,
George's.
Is so excited. And they get to fly first class. And then they get to fly in a private plane with Elton John. And RuPaul is like, I forgot how cool my life is. And it was really fun seeing it through George's eyes.
Especially because it's been like 18 months since RuPaul has been successful.
Yeah. And he really likes George's, but he's only 21 and RuPaul is 33 at this point. He's just like, I don't know, he's too young for me, but he's just so nice. I've never met a nice man before. He's like, I know I've always tried to recreate my relationship with my dad by chasing people, but what if someone chased me? What if somebody just liked me and was nice?
So George has asked him on a date, but he says, you're too young. And they go, can we still be friends? And then he's helping George's unpack his apartment. And he's like, oh my God, you're so cute. Actually, we could date.
But with George's, I slept soundly, and so did he, as if sheltered by the sanctuary we created for each other.
Their relationship does seem a bit odd. They have this like agreement to not talk about problems and upset each other.
He also has this problem where he's 21 years old, so he graduates from FIT and he gets a job working as a designer at J. Crew. But RuPaul's like, how are you going to follow me around the world and make my life more fun if you're working? And so he quits his job to become his full-time boyfriend. And RuPaul's well, I don't think it's good for you to just be my full-time boyfriend because you can't self-actualize. So what if I give you a little project? I'm going to buy a place down in Miami and you can decorate it with your good eye. And that'll give you a little something to work on and be proud of.
There's distance between him and George's as RuPaul continues to jet all over the world, becoming more and more famous. Having money to me felt like a tank full of gas. It didn't mean much if you didn't know where you were going and you didn't have the curiosity to enjoy the ride. Money made things easier, much easier. But no matter how poor I'd been, I'd never felt as impoverished as the rich people I know who had no imagination.
George starts renovating and then they're seeing each other less and less. Things are getting more distant. Every time he sees him, he's like, wow, he's getting real skinny. And he's like, I bet he's doing some things that I don't want to know about. So let me just not ask.
Yeah. And then finally, they're together because it was RuPaul's sister's wedding. And George goes, I have to tell you something. I'm addicted to crystal meth. And RuPaul is calling friends being like, what should I do? And they're like, take him to rehab. When he checks George's into rehab, George says he was suicidal. And RuPaul's like, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, RuPaul's like, I guess I had no idea what was going on with him. I don't think RuPaul realized what was going on. He's like, he was so out of it that George asked for his own room. And they said, well, we can only give you your own room if you're not suicidal. Are you suicidal? And George is like, yes. And RuPaul's like, come on, put two and two together. Don't you want your own room? Don't say that. But so he takes him to this AA meeting and this woman is telling the story about her life. And everything she said rang true to my own story. Is this some sort of a hoax, I thought? Everything she's saying is mine. The awareness didn't take long. It came on strong and clear and loud almost instantaneously. This is where I belonged. When you hear your story told through someone else's mouth, you know you've arrived at the right place. This is where I belonged. It was like a fantastical trick had been played on me. George's was the one in rehab. And yet I was also hitting rock bottom.
I'd been smoking weed and I'd been smoking first thing in the morning. I'd been buying coke from the sleaziest dealer in New York, a guy who sold footage of celebrities getting high on heroin to the tabloids and snorting it all by myself. He realizes he's been high almost every day since he was 12 and it was time to get sober. I still think it's a little bit self-centered to be like, oh my God, my boyfriend was like fully addicted to crystal meth and dying, but it was a lesson the universe had in store for moi.
Yeah, he's like, if he was in this much trouble, what did that say about me? So they keep going to meetings together. And then RuPaul's like, I need to go back to LA. And George's is like, I think I need to stay in Miami. And RuPaul's like, well, this is where you did all that crystal meth, though. And George's is like, yeah. And RuPaul's like, well, if you don't come with me to LA, then I think we're breaking up. And George's is like, okay. So they break up and he gets sober and he starts going to therapy. And his therapist was like, I had told you I couldn't really do work with you until you were sober. So they start going to serious therapy. He's like going every day. And he starts realizing that part of his problems is that he never felt like he had a home before. Because his childhood home had been so tumultuous. Literally, he was homeless for a lot of times in his 20s. And he wanted to start feeling safe building a community. He had never felt comfortable inviting friends over to his home growing up. And he's like, I'm going to build a community. I'm going to make this my home. And he starts throwing really fun parties and inviting people from AA and Hollywood over.
He like really reconnects with his family.
He likes being back on the West Coast where he can be near his nieces and nephews.
I understood that my dissociative self was born the day my mother tried to set fire to my father's car, and from that moment, I had started using drugs and I'd been chasing that dissociative state, trying not to be fully present in my body, trying to separate myself from the pain and trauma that lurked in the shadows. For so long, I'd been motivated by one destiny, fame, but now that I'd gotten it, what else was there? And so now he's, you know, famous and reconnecting with family.
And then it's just the epilogue.
And the epilogue goes back to Atlanta and getting those tapes of the American Music Show. I looked out the window at the building being demolished and it doesn't seem so serious anymore. After all, I learned a long time ago, nothing really is. I zip up my suitcase, I'm already home. I find it very fascinating that the whole lead up of this book, or like the whole purpose of this book, right, is about discovering a sense of self, is about community and home and family, and like that the pursuit of fame isn't everything. But since the events of this book cut off, there has been much more fame.
Him and George's are married.
Yeah.
That's left kind of unclear at the end of this book, which is odd.
Well, not unclear, just absolutely unmentioned. I just happened to Google.
He says at the end of the book, we talk about getting back together, but we don't know. You wouldn't know.
I wonder if George's has to be written out in the later years in order to avoid the fracking convo. Because George's is a rancher.
Yeah, he inherited a ranch in Wyoming, even though he's Australian. Anyway, I mean, it was an interesting book. I'm deeply curious about the framing.
I liked this book, but it left me with like a lot of questions about RuPaul.
Yeah, I would love to ask him why he chose to stop where he stopped. I also am actually deeply curious about what he would like the queer community to take from this book.
Mm-hmm.
Because the book does feel very much about his exceptionalism and not necessarily
a queer experience at all.
Yeah.
In moments of exploring his identity, he makes a real point to say, like, this is not representative of the Black experience. I don't know about that. This is not representative of the queer experience. I don't know about that. I'm different.
I'm a star.
Which I think it's also annoying when someone overgeneralizes and they say, like, as I can say from the entire community, like, no one can say on behalf of an entire community.
Interesting choices were made.
Yeah.
I thought it's like somebody who's done a lot of work. I think there are probably reasons, and I wish we could ask him about it.
Me too.
I don't think it was done sloppily.
No. This book is very carefully written.
And it's like of the mind of a man who's done a lot of excavation and analyzation.
I wonder if like we're going to get an announcement today about part two. I guess I find it so fascinating that someone who is currently, I would say, at the height of a career chose to put out a book that like kind of implies 20 years ago I became famous and I realized I didn't actually care about that really.
Because there's all the work after you get sober of rebuilding that life. And do you know what I mean? Like this is the beginning.
Totally. This is part one.
So there you have it. And Ashley.
Yes, Claire.
How fertile would you say the soil was?
I would kind of say 3.
Interesting.
How fertile would you say the soil is?
3, 7, 5, I'll give it.
Okay. How many worm teenies would you want to have?
Can I tell you? Actually, I have no idea.
I think 4. I have a lot of questions. We need a long conversation.
I kind of feel like I walk away from this book being like, which version of him?
Yeah.
I think I would have loved to have a drink with him at 25, 26.
Oh yeah, I guess he's sober.
Well, but I also just mean that it's hard to say who the man that's writing this book today is.
Yeah.
This version of him at 35 who's like committed to throwing parties and building community, that sounds so fun. The part of him that's just running around living life to laugh, to see the absurdity of all, I feel like that's so fun. I am curious, who is he today?
You'd have to have a worm teeny or two to find out.
Yeah, so I guess a worm teeny or two. And Ashley, who do we love the most?
Oh, we love our 5-star reviewing wormies. Thank you, Kathy Sarasota. I would fly all the way to Sarasota just to give you a smooch on the cheek and a thank you. Thank you, Srahahahaha. Do you know what makes me laugh is thinking about the joy that we bring to each other's lives. Coop 3R8. All I need is a little coupe to drive down the road in. One seat for me, one seat for you. We're driving off into the distance, and I love you. Thank you, MEMCK134. I would give you an Emmy Award for this review. And that is all for this week. Thank you guys so much. I freaking love you.